Okay, we're back. It is February 13th.
No, not yet.
Maybe the 12th?
10th.
Ooh, February 10th. Here we go.
Last time I talked a good deal about things which happened in certain month involving my participation in the farm labor movement. I didn't say much about my work for the health department, but I was reminded of something that happened in June of 65. Which is possibly worth mentioning. I had forgotten that I managed to produce a monograph about things that happened in Santa Cruz County before I ever joined the health department. A number of other people had been interested in the subject of the health care of old age people in that county, which has an unusually high number of persons over 65. And in fact, they are about one third of the population. So they were the object of some research by various hands, which lay fallow until a medical care studies unit was created within the public health department, the state public health department, under the leadership of a public health physician named Lester Breslow. And I became a member of that unit, and it fell to me to pull together these scraps of research that had been done by a number of other people over the years, and to try to make a monograph out of them. Well, I had forgotten that I did, in fact, produce such a thing, and it turns out to be 137 pages long, and it was published in a fairly neat-looking format. And that was in June of 1965. Then, I went back to my own piece of research in Santa Cruz County, in which I did a study of every person over 65 years of age in one of the towns of Santa Cruz County called Capitola, and we did, in fact, have a questionnaire administered to all these people, and then it was a matter of coding the results and just starting to try to analyze them by the new computer that the health department had acquired. And this went very slowly, very slowly. So that things in the farm labor field seemed to me to take precedence, and I have to admit that I spent more time on that than perhaps I should have, but there didn't seem to be much else for me to do in the health department. In September of 1965, I think it was the 16th, I think that happens to be a national holiday in Mexico, what they consider to be their Independence Day, not to be confused with Cinco de Mayo, which was kind of the equivalent of they're overthrowing a domestic tyrant rather than freeing themselves from Spain, which took place way back in like 1830 or something like that. Anyway, on September 16th of 1965, the organization, which had been started by Cesar Chavez in 1962, was faced with a dilemma. The Filipinos in the Delano area, who made up a substantial part of the labor force in grapes, which was the principal crop in that area. The Filipinos were an important part of the farm labor force, but not the majority force. But they had enjoyed a success in a little strike in the Coachella Valley in the spring. And felt that they were entitled to get the same sort of wages and working conditions in Delano that they had achieved in the Coachella Valley, and so they struck again. And Chavez and his small organization, not a union, he was very careful to call it an association, the Farm Workers Association, FWA. They were, in fact, the majority of the grape workers force in the Delano area. And if they continued to work, it would wipe out any chance of the Filipinos succeeding in their work action, as they call it. So there was a rally, and Chavez tried to make it clear to his membership that it was not going to be a piece of cake, that he had planned when he began his organizing efforts in 1962 that it might be 5 years before they were strong enough to have a good chance of any such thing as a strike. And here it was, 2 years ahead of schedule, and yet they were on the horns of this dilemma. And he was no rabble rouser, and he didn't try to tip the scales one way or the other, but the members of the organization were gung-ho to become more active than they had up to that point, and so they overwhelmingly, in fact unanimously, voted to join the Filipinos on strike. And it wouldn't do to have two separate organizations, and so they formed what they called the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee, UFOC, in which supposedly the Filipino element and the Mexican element were co-equals. Filipinos being led by a man named Larry Itleong, who had been a staff member with AWOC for some years, and the Farm Workers Association, of course, being headed by Chavez himself. Well, from that point on, The the organization that I had started, called Citizens for Farm Labor, became sort of spear carriers with Youth Walk leading the way. And we existed primarily to help them in whatever ways we could without being in any sense dominant. We didn't want to be involved in the decision-making processes. But we did things like organize car caravans loaded with supplies that the strikers would need, and we relied entirely upon their wishes. And we didn't have barrels outside of supermarkets in which well-meaning people could throw a can of tomatoes or something, whatever, from time to time. The organizations down in Delano wanted things in bulk. They wanted 100-pound sacks of beans. They wanted 100-pound sacks of flour. They wanted cases of canned goods, not a can here and there. And so we of Citizens for Farm Labor would help in ways like loading a pickup truck with boxes of canned goods. And there's a picture of one of our active members named Bob Callaghy. And that's his pickup truck, and he painted on the side, Citizens for Farm Labor, I guess down at the bottom, supporting the strikers. And we began developing, devoting much of our monthly magazine, what we called our monthly magazine, although it was more often bi-weekly, bi-monthly. We devoted news about the strike in that way and in various ways, speeches and so forth. We helped out with that strike. And it struck the public imagination in ways that no farm labor strike in the long history of such things in California had ever done before. It's hard to know exactly why, but I'm sure it was a combination of things. The times were ripe for social action. It was taking place, of course, in the area of civil rights. There was no immediate problem of racial discrimination in California, and so people were looking for other forms of social injustice. And that was one of the things that we stressed in our organization's Citizens for Farm Labor. Our slogan was equal rights for farm workers, because in fact there was just as much discrimination in the economic field against that particular industry, that is to say that particular form of workers, as there was against Negroes in the South when it came to voting or various other forms of social participation. So people flocked to Delano to volunteer their help with the strike. We lost most of our best workers who were helping put out the magazine and various other activities of CFL. But we were happy to help in that way. But there were so many other hundreds, I suppose, of students and others who went to Delano to offer their services on the picket lines or whatever they might do. It became a problem for Chavez and the other leaders of that group down there because a lot of these kids were very immature and all of them were totally ignorant about the realities of farm work, ignorant about the realities of unionism, and in fact, it was a watchword in the labor movement that volunteers were really a danger and frequently were more harm than good. As the saying went, since they haven't been hired, they can't be fired. And so volunteers were simply not allowed in many organizing efforts and strikes by established unions. But since neither the Filipinos nor the Mexicans in Delano had established unions, they were happy to have volunteers so long as the volunteers were willing to submit to a reasonable amount of discipline. And so the leadership had to lay down certain rules. They had rules about substance abuse. I don't think that they had any drinking or any pot smoking. I think they probably had some reasonable limitations on hanky-panky between the boys and the girls. I'm sure a number of people were simply told, please go back where you came from. We don't want your presence here any longer. And it worked. They were able to maintain picket lines and attracted a lot of attention from the media, all of which was favorable. The media loved the idea of a David versus Goliath confrontation. They had a number of pretty good public speakers who were able to give sound bites to the television crews that came around. Chavez himself was not among the most polished at making these sound bites, so he let other people do that. They began experimenting with different tactics than had been used before. There had been a lot of efforts to organize farm workers in the state of California, dating back at least to the 1910s, when the IWW had a presence here. And there were serious efforts to organize unions in the 1930s, all of which were crushed. There were efforts in the 1950s, before AWOC, and then of course there was AWOC itself, if you want to call that a serious effort. At least it spent a lot more money than the others ever had. But it occurred to the leadership of UFOC to try to get the consuming public involved in a way which had never been tried before, and that is to call for a boycott of a specific agricultural product, namely grapes, which was produced in a specific area, namely the lower end of the San Joaquin Valley. And for all practical purposes, this meant a boycott of table grapes wherever they might be sold, because that particular area had a virtual monopoly on the production of that crop in the country and even overseas. So it was a matter of getting people who were really seriously committed to making a personal sacrifice by leaving home and going out and organizing boycotts in various cities around the country and to some extent even overseas. They organized a national and even international boycott of California table grapes, which was, for all practical purposes, a boycott of grapes, period. And it worked. The strikers were helped greatly by the cooperation of certain other unions, particularly the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, the ILWU, which of course was a very well-known left-wing union centered in San Francisco, but it had contacts in other ports, and the ILWU was in theory bound by U.S. labor laws. And in the 1940s, when the Republicans were for a time in control of Congress, they passed something called the Taft-Hartley Act, which, among other things, forbade secondary boycotts. A union couldn't boycott a product in sympathy with some other union. That was called a secondary boycott and was illegal, and the union guilty of it could be severely penalized. the ILW, the ILWU didn't care. It went ahead with the secondary boycott and had the strength and the financial resources to fight any effort to prevent their doing so. And by the time that these legal battles could be fought, the season was over and the whole thing became moot. So that was very effective. And then volunteers from this group of mostly young students, some of them dropped out of school and were willing to devote a year or whatever they could spare to helping the union. They would go into these towns around these mostly big cities scattered around the country, on into Canada and so forth, and they would sit outside of supermarkets with tables of literature and so forth, and talk to people. And this was all perfectly legal. The stores sometimes would try to roust them out for trespassing, but the union was able to call on some volunteer lawyers to argue that they had the right under the Free Speech Amendment, and they almost always won those fights. So as I say, the boycott was not 100%, but sufficiently effective that it made a difference. And the UFOC also found that a lot of the grapes were then being diverted from the fresh market to the manufacture of alcoholic beverages. And so they extended their boycott to the producers of wines and liquors. And somehow the Shenley Corporation became one of their big targets. I don't know exactly why, but possibly because they had a reason, the strike leaders may have some reason to believe that the Shenley Corporation was vulnerable. And so, lo and behold, that was the first capitulation by an employer. Another one of the tactics which the union hit upon was a march. A march from Delano to the capital of California. It's about, 250 miles or maybe more than that. It was is going to be a march just to publicize their cause, counting on the fact that it would be considered newsworthy, and in fact it was. A number of well-known people took part, at least for one stage or another of this long march, while Chavez himself and a number of other members stayed with it for the entire length. Movie stars would take part, for example, for 10 miles or 20 miles or something like that. And by the end of this march, about 10,000 people had joined for the final stage, and there was an enormous rally on the grounds of the state capitol. I guess one of the reasons for the march was to influence the state legislature, which was in session, I believe, and as usual, there were bills before this legislature of California trying to get the passage of certain laws which would, in fact, have conferred equal rights upon farm workers that they hadn't ever enjoyed before, such as coverage by unemployment insurance and a minimum wage law, and the collective bargaining rights, and so forth. Well, I don't think that the legislature passed any of these laws on this particular session, but in time it did. Now, all this was taking time from the activities of Citizens for Farm Labor, such as the production of our magazine. So it became impossible to do it every month. And it was increasingly difficult for me without the help of Wendy Gopal and Bill Escher and Kathy Lynch and others who were all down in Delano. And I just wasn't able to do it all by myself. But I persevered as best I could because I now was juggling more than ever before my responsibilities in the health department. Just a few months before the great strike began in Delano in September, a dramatic event took place in Washington, D.C., which, in the long historical view, was a good deal more important. On July 30th of 1965, the Congress had passed two amendments to the Social Security Act, and they had been signed into law by Lyndon Johnson. Technically, they were called Title 18 and 19 of the original act, which had been passed back in 1936. Title 18 created a problem called Medicare. And Title 19 created a program called Medicaid. These had been violently opposed, of course, by the American Medical Association, which considered them to be socialized medicine. But the Medicare program said in so many words that anyone over 65, regardless of their income, was eligible to be covered by this program of health insurance. Which was largely to be paid for by contributions to a new fund. Withholding from one's income. Title 19, the Medicaid program, was a program for those who were not able to afford to pay anything toward maintenance of the system. It was based upon need, and also it had no age requirements. Well, this was a veritable revolution in healthcare. The Title 18 program, the Medicare program, was entirely administered by the federal government. The Medicaid program was different in that it was optional, state by state. If a state wanted to take part, it could do so by paying half the costs. The federal government would pay the other half. And in order for that to happen in a given state, the state legislature would have to vote to approve of participation and to vote the funding for its half of it. And this in turn meant that there might have to be a special session of the legislature called, and that might take some time. California I think was in the middle of a session, legislative session, and the balance of 1965. So that in December, I believe it was in December, the legislature did vote for participation in the Medicaid system, voted to appropriate some hundred millions of dollars or something of the sort. And gave the California version of the Medicaid program its own name, Medi-Cal. Now, it seems that this was a logical place for the Medical Care Studies Unit, which had been set up by Dr. Breslow considerable time before it was even known there was ever going to be such a thing passed by the National Congress. He had set up a Medical Care Studies Unit. It seemed to be a logical place for that unit to have certain responsibilities for the administration of the Medi-Cal program. And I'm not privy to what must have gone on, but it seems that there was a tug of war between the State Department of Public Welfare and the State Department of Public Health as to how the responsibilities could be divided up. The Welfare Department obviously had some considerable experience with establishing the eligibility of people who were of low income as to whether they were eligible for other types of social welfare programs. On the other hand, the Social Welfare Department didn't know much about medical care. So there must have been a lot of backroom haggling. All I do know is that the end result was that the Welfare Department got the biggest slice of the pie, if that's the right way to look at it. The Health Department got the responsibility, or the right, if it wanted to use it, to conduct what was called surveillance. And that was not well defined. In fact, it was ill defined. In fact, it wasn't defined at all. Something called a surveillance unit was set up. And something of a structure It was actually within a larger bureau. And Dr. Breslow, who by this time had worked his way up in the bureaucracy to the point where he had become director of the entire state public health department, and he put in charge of this new bureau of health research, or whatever it was called. I've got it written down somewhere, but the name doesn't make too much difference. He prevailed upon a man named Eric Reynolds, who had been in the private practice of internal medicine for many years, but had retired. Breslow prevailed upon him to become head of the Bureau of Medical Research, or whatever the name, that's pretty close to what I think it was called, of which the surveillance unit was one part. And Rick Reynolds, as we called him, even though he had been sufficiently good at the politics of medicine, that he had been at one time the president of the California Medical Association, he was a good guy. And I liked him a lot. But he didn't know anything about statistics or how to evaluate a program such as the Medicaid program. Now it should be understood that in some way or other, the surveillance unit was supposed to look at whatever data there might be to judge how well it was performing, how well the Medicaid system was accomplishing what it was intended to. And there were a number of other people in the hierarchy between myself and Eric Reynolds, and above him was an assistant director named Dr. Robert Day, and then there was Breslow. There were still others in the hierarchy between Reynolds and myself. But they all looked to me, maybe because I had a master's degree in medical care administration, they looked to me to decide what surveillance meant. And how it could be carried out. Well, it was in a way a very But on the other hand, it was very good to feel that I was in a position in which I might actually accomplish something. In other words, that I might care deeply in what I was doing and not just drawing a monthly paycheck. In a way, it was the equivalent of something that I had hoped I would feel when I was research director for AWOC, that it was an opportunity for me to make a difference in the world. Well, that didn't work out. In a way, I was able to feel I was accomplishing something useful as head of Citizens for Farm Labor. Except it couldn't compare with the importance of what was going on in Delano. But here was something in which I could feel I was really perhaps making a difference in the world. And so I threw myself into it. Although, at the same time, I still cared very much about the farm labor movement. And I should mention that I was also, at the same time, supposedly co-authoring a book with Joan London, which had a publisher lined up. So I was really juggling things in almost a schizophrenic manner, when it came to the concept of surveillance of the Medicaid program. What I had to work with was a set of tapes, which under agreement between the welfare and health departments were sent at the close of every month from Sacramento, Berkeley, and these tapes contained information about every payment that had been made to every vendor of health care services during that month. Information identifying the name and license number of the vendor, a code which represented the nature of the service that had been rendered. There were hundreds of codes, procedure codes is what they were called. And they would go into detail such as a brief office visit, defined as 10 minutes or less, a different number, for an office visit of 15 minutes, an office visit of half an hour, and so forth. Great detail. There was another code for the nature of the condition for which the service had been rendered. There would be information about the amount billed. And there was information about the amount actually paid. So I looked at all these things and talked with the head of our tabulation unit. I think that's what it was called at the time. This fellow was a friend of mine dating back to the very first time I ever got into the field of public health. It was in San Francisco in November of 1952, when I was at the very bottom of the rung in the Bureau of Records and Statistics. Before there was any such thing as a computer. At least we didn't know of any such thing. But by 1965, the health department had a fairly advanced model of a computer. And therefore, we were able to think of ways in which these raw data contained in these tapes that we got from the welfare department, how could we look at them in a way which would illuminate the question of whether the program was doing what it was intended to, which was to provide medical care of a quality which was equivalent to what the general public had a right to expect. The California version of Medicaid, as we called it, Medi-Cal, specifically stated that vendors were allowed to charge their usual and customary fees. The assumption was that this would make the quality of care equal to what the middle class and the upper class were receiving. Well, ideally, we would have been able to link Diagnoses. With services. And we would have been able to make judgments as to whether the services were appropriate to the diagnoses. And ideally, we would have been able to make certain judgments as to whether the treatments had been successful. But it soon became quite evident that the diagnostic coding was full of errors. So we were forced to fall back on measurements of different indices. It turned out to be usually a matter of quantity of services rather than appropriateness. So we were able to look at the sheer number of patients that a doctor claimed he saw per day. That sort of thing. We were able to look at the sheer number of injections that a physician claimed he gave, or chest x-rays, or various other types of procedures. And we were then able to make distributions which would categorize vendors, and we were interested particularly in medical doctors. We would group them by those who, on average, claimed they saw ten patients a day, 20, 30, 40, 50, etc. And we thought that we would select out for particular surveillance those who were at some extreme. In the distribution of whatever index we were interested in measuring, those who might fall in the upper 1 or 2%, let's say, because we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of participating physicians. When we found that there were, say, a dozen physicians in the 2% with respect to patients seen per day. We would ask Steve Gibbons, the head of the tabulation unit, to send us a printout of all the claims of those 10 or 12 physicians during that month. And I was given a couple of helpers. And we would go over these claims very carefully. We would look up whatever we could find about the physician himself, whether what medical school he had been to, what medical specialty he practiced, where his practice was located, etc. And we found a number of very, very interesting things. We found some physicians who claimed that they were seeing so many patients that it came to an average of about 3 minutes per patient. And we were prepared to judge that they were probably not getting a level of quality of care that the average member of the public was receiving. And so it went with the various other things that we might look at. There were cases in which we found that a certain physician was claiming that he gave an injection to every patient, regardless of the diagnosis. And we thought that was probably not a good quality of care, if in fact it were true. And other physicians were claiming that they gave every patient a chest x-ray, regardless of the diagnosis. We were greatly struck by a physician who apparently had a practice in an area where the norm was large families. And this physician claimed that he would see a mother with 5 or 6 children all of whom had the same diagnosis, which was a common cold, and
they all received injections
and chest x-rays.
Oh my God. What a windfall.
So you laugh.
Well, my helpers and I weren't amused. The program was being gamed, as they say nowadays. And so we began sending monthly reports to the State Department of Public Welfare about these guys. They were almost all men, as I remember correct. I don't remember any women who were bleeding the system that way. They were largely concentrated in the Los Angeles area. We began sending them the plain record and letting the record speak for itself. Because the Social Welfare Department had the power of enforcement. We didn't. We were strictly a research unit. And the Welfare Department did not take action. We went up to Sacramento and tried to talk to them. About the danger to the program, which was going to run into the red in a hurry if this sort of thing continued. And we were told that they had to accept that there might be some deviations, but that the main thing was to get the program off the ground and to get enough vendors participating to make sure that the needy were able to find people taking part in the program. The Welfare Department was deathly afraid that if the system were too carefully policed, that doctors would stop taking part in it altogether. And then we had the idea of communicating some of these findings to the medical societies in areas such as Los Angeles, in the hopes that they would do something about what we considered to be the rotten apples in their own barrels. And I do believe that the head of our bureau, that is Rick Reynolds, who used to be the head of the entire medical association for the state, I think he might have used some of his good offices to send this information to the societies down in Los Angeles with perhaps a cover letter. Maybe he even telephoned some of these fellows. I'm sure he had friends all over the state, telling them that they might be killing the goose that was laying the golden egg if they didn't clean up their act. And we got back the following report. That in fact, the fellow that we had identified as the guy who specialized in large families, that he had been called to speak to a meeting of his local medical society. And he had given an eloquent defense of his pattern of practice. Saying that he was providing a service which should be appreciated by the physicians in the middle class and upper class neighborhoods. By continuing to serve the people in the ghettos. Otherwise, the ghetto dwellers would start going to seek care in the middle class and possibly even the upper class doctors' offices. And how would they like that to happen? And then, in the end, according to our information, and I'm sure it was true, they gave this fellow a standing ovation. All of this was disappointing, and yet we kept at it. And in fact, some changes were made, although not in the direction that we would have liked. In the next session of the legislature, they had to change the law which had specified usual and customary fees. They had to establish a fee schedule. In the hopes that would cut down on some of the abuses.
my opinion, it was simply an impossible situation. That is to say, that the fee-for-service system itself was the culprit, because it was an open invitation to game the system. That the fee-for-service system was incompatible with a publicly funded program. The physician could change the coding of the procedure if he wanted to cover up in the cards. The fee-for-service system continues, and I've seen it in my own case. And I'm not in a welfare system. I was not good grief, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Well, that's a little fast.
Well,
close.
I'm really gonna have to continue this because I'm not quite finished, but not tonight.